Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's summertime, and there's suddenly an added incentive for folks to get outside and spend some time walking in nature. The Pokemon Go craze has swept the nation. 20-year-old video game has found new life as an augmented reality game being played on cell phones all over the country. What's really interesting is the impact it seems to be having in the healthcare arena, at least in the short term. Margaret, I've really enjoyed this game.
I know you haven't. So did I when I tried it. We're seeing it here in our health center facilities. We're getting reports from others all around the country. Clinicians reporting that their patients and entire families, for that matter, have been getting out together for long walks in the out of doors, all in pursuit of the capture of Pokemon monsters and hopefully some nice time with their families as well. A big component of winning the game is the number of miles you travel on foot in pursuit of your targets. And I've tried it. It's a pretty fun way to move around with others. So you do need to watch out where you're going.
We're also hearing from behavioral health clinicians that it's becoming an interesting incentive for folks battling depression and other issues to become more engaged. And it's also helping folks to socialize more, bringing people together in public places all over the country. I think the phenomenon proves that there's really a readiness for people to use wearables and mobile technologies to facilitate health, fitness, wellness while playing this game.
If it's working to get our patients moving more, we're all for it.
Absolutely. You know, Margaret, it calls to mind an interview we did earlier this year with Jeff Williams, Chief Operating Officer of Apple. He's overseeing the tech giant's foray into the health feed with the Apple Watch, Apple Health Kit, and Apple Research Kit. It's an exciting new platform that will facilitate hundreds of millions of customers potentially to gain a better understanding of health metrics and to share their health data for research if they so choose.
Well, terrific interview, Mark. And Lori Robertson stops by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org. She's still on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Jeff Williams in just a moment.
But here first is our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Congress has adjourned for the summer, having taken no action on the emergency Zika virus legislation. As the mosquito season heads into high gear, more cases are cropping up in the country, still largely related to travel to the regions with the highest concentration of the virus. Scientists are learning more about human-to-human transmission of the virus. The CDC has warned for some time that Zika can be transmitted sexually from male to female partners, and the virus can last much longer in the system than previously thought, thus elevating the risk to pregnant women. Now there's evidence the virus can be transmitted from females to males. Health officials report a case involving a New York City woman who had contracted Zika while traveling and passed it on to her partner upon return. The CDC is upgrading its Zika prevention guidelines to include this latest warning. After more than a year of trying, Congress has finally passed significant legislation to combat America's opioid epidemic. The Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act sailed through the Senate on a 92-2 vote after a similarly overwhelming show of support in the House of Representatives. The law seeks to enhance community resources to tackle an ongoing opioid overdose scourge, which claimed the lives of more than 28,000 Americans in 2014. But President Obama had asked for authorization for more than $1 billion to pay for all the programs needed to run intervention on this public health crisis. The bill authorized no funds for the measure. While President Obama criticized the bill as weak, he intended to sign the legislation to signal some forward motion on this critical health issue. Republican leadership has said they'll make a separate appropriation to fund the measure when they return in September. Ah, summertime. Time to kick back, load the minivan, and head off to a vacation destination for a week or two. Well, if you're a typical overworked American, that may no longer be the case. A study done recently by NPR, Kaiser Health News, and the Harvard School of Public Health showed over 50% of those who work 50 hours a week or more never take their full amount of vacation time, and some take none at all. And of those who do take vacation, 30% admit to being on their smartphones during that time off. A third of those polled say they don't take vacation because they want to get ahead. And early to bed, early to rise makes a child healthy, wealthy, and thinner. Interesting study on the link between a child's early bedtime and the development of obesity, a longitudinal study published in the journal Pediatrics, looking at the impact of bedtime for children and obesity, found those toddlers and young children who were put to bed no later than 8 p.m. tended to have lower obesity as teens than young children whose bedtime was 9 p.m. or beyond. When the preschoolers reached age 15, 10% of the early to bed group, 16% of the middle group, and 23% of the late to bed group were obese, even after researchers controlled for other factors like birth weight, socioeconomic status, ethnicity, and mother's weight. The preschoolers who went to bed late were twice as likely to develop obesity in their teens as the early to bed group. So in addition to diet and exercise, getting more shut-eye at an earlier time may be one important tool in reducing rates of childhood obesity. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Jeff Williams, Chief Operating Officer of Apple, overseeing the development of Apple Watch and driving the company's health initiatives, including Research Kit, which is aimed at simplifying medical and health research. Jeff joined Apple in 1998 as head of worldwide procurement, and he played a key role in Apple's entry into the mobile phone market with the launch of the iPhone in 2007. Since 2010, he's overseen Apple's entire supply chain, as well as service and support and social responsibility initiatives. Prior to his tenure at Apple, Mr. Williams worked at IBM for 13 years in both engineering and operational capacities. He earned his master's in mechanical engineering from North Carolina State and his MBA from Duke. Jeff, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be with you.
What a great story Apple has since its birth in that California garage in the 80s. Apple has been synonymous with innovation and groundbreaking technology. We've cycled through quite a few consumer products since then, multiple iterations of the Mac, the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, and the most recent Apple launch is the Apple Watch, which CEO Tim Cook has described as a new intimate way to communicate from your wrist. Could you tell our listeners about the genesis of the Apple Watch and how it's advancing? This idea of wearables as the ideal communication device that may help facilitate the advance of medical research as well.
Yeah, actually, Mark, you know, I think people think that Apple just picks a new category and peers into the future and then somehow comes up with a revolutionary product. But the process is much more organic. In this case, many years ago, Johnny and the ID team started looking at ideas, how you might interface with a small screen, and we were surprised at how compelling that was. New ideas surfaced, and it ultimately ended in us producing the Apple Watch. And in terms of health and communication, the two biggest things we've seen in terms of response on the watch are actually in those two categories. The first is people are telling us that the watch helps them be more present. The fact that they're able to triage their communications quickly has been really helpful. But the biggest impact has actually been on health. Quite honestly, we've been surprised and very inspired. So many people have written to us saying it's helped them lose weight, it's helped them be more active. They were pre-diabetics and have changed course. And even we've gotten a ton of emails where people are saying the watch actually saved their life. First email I got to this effect, I thought this must be somebody joking, because the only thing on the Apple Watch from a true medical sensor standpoint is the heart rate sensor, and anybody can get their pulse. You just put two fingers on your wrist and watch the clock. But having the information readily available, and possibly more important, the fact that it's passively tracked, it's tracked in the background, has proved to be profound in a way we didn't anticipate. We've gotten so many emails where people or their cardiologist have written us and said, this person detected something on their watch and came in and they had a life-threatening situation, and if we had not intervened, they probably would have died. Or the person that goes in and they're sitting on their couch a couple days later and they look at their iPhone because they have an Apple Watch and they see that, wow, I can see my heart rate throughout the day and I notice I have this severe drop in blood pressure. They take it back to the doctor and they say, wow, you've got this condition that needs to be addressed. The fact that it's monitored, it gives people a more continuous view versus just a snapshot into their health. And so we think we're just at the beginning and couldn't be more excited about the future.
Well, you know, as we were preparing to talk to you, we were saying that in some ways it seems like the cart came before the horse, in the sense that you initially developed the Apple Health Kit as a place for users to be able to store their health data. And other companies certainly had entered this space, the former Microsoft Health Vault and Google Health, which did not survive. And we've had some of those participants from those initiatives on the show who told us it was just too soon for people to feel comfortable storing personal health data in the cloud. What's different about Apple Health Kit, and what kinds of health data is it designed to capture? How protected is it? And why do you think the market and people are finally ready for this kind of iteration?
We took a completely different approach. In fact, we don't store your information at all. We put the user squarely in control of their health data. Maybe the best way to describe this isn't exactly how it works, but think of your phone. Inside your phone, there's a little safe, and you are the safe manager. And so let's say you have a blood pressure cuff, a Bluetooth or a scale or whatever that collects input. You decide whether to let that device write information into your little safe that's on your phone. And then let's say you want to share that data. You've got hypertension and you've got a healthcare provider that wants to track your blood pressure results. You decide whether you want to allow data to leave that little safe on your phone and go to the healthcare provider through their app. And Apple doesn't store your data. It's not out in the cloud. Mm-hmm. And that's the approach. But you are right. We did not set out with a goal to go into the health data business. It really surfaced as a need. We were working on the watch. We needed a place to store data. And as we looked at it, we said, wow, I think there's a problem to solve. And so we don't actually think in terms of markets. We tend to think in terms of, is there a problem that needs to be solved for people, and can we produce something that's really inspiring and helpful? And that's how we entered here.
And if you connect the dots there, you have 700 million iPhone users around the world. After Apple launched its Health Kit in 2014, you realized that this treasure trove of health information was being generated by users. Could you tell our listeners about how did Apple Health Kit lead to Apple Research Kit, and how do all those pieces fit together?
The real beginning here was we were talking with medical experts because we were building the watch, and we had this idea of Health Kit as a place to store it. And as we were talking with them, the conversations would often drift to problems they faced in research. And as we listened to these problems, we saw a huge opportunity to help. In fact, there's been such amazing progress in medical research, but the engine that drives that, the studies, that process hasn't changed in decades. And the number one problem that researchers face is actually recruiting participants.
Right.
And as a result, you can have 20, 50, maybe 100 people in a study if you're lucky. You know, I've always believed people are willing to help, but there's too much friction in the system. If you participate in a research study, you have to usually drive to the location, you have to sign legalese documents for consent, and people just don't have the time. And so we saw a huge opportunity to take advantage of the phone, the fact that people have it with them all the time, the fact that it has powerful sensors that can aid in research, and so we started working on Research Kit.
So if I've got it right, any researcher can download and create an app specific to their own area of targeted research, whether it's Parkinson's disease or type 2 diabetes or asthma. The researcher then develops their app, makes it available for free through the App Store. And I understand that some of the early data from a search kit has already led to some significant advances in understanding certain disease pathologies. Who are some of your ground floor medical research partners? How are they choosing to utilize Research Kit in unique ways? And maybe the kinds of advances that you've seen by tapping into these larger pools of research participants?
In terms of institutions, we've been working with so many around the world, leading ones, Stanford, Oxford, Beijing University, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, and the list goes on. Maybe the best way to explain Research Kit is to talk about a disease. Let's talk about Parkinson's.
Great.
Parkinson's a movement disorder. It affects millions of people. If you think about how you would study Parkinson's today, you would have to recruit patients. They have to come into the office. They have to have assessments from doctors. And there's problems with that. So we did something different. We took advantage of the fact that there are powerful sensors on the phone. One of the prime ways that you study Parkinson's is to have a patient walk in front of you, and the doctor assesses their gait imbalance. With Research Kit, you can use the accelerometer and the gyroscope on the phone, and a person can just do a walk test, put the phone in their pocket and conduct a walk test, and they can do it anywhere, not just in the doctor's office. Or they can do a tap test on the phone instead of having the physician assess them while they tap their fingers in the office. And so what this did is it allowed people all over the United States and other parts of the world participate in a study that in a prior process would have required them to go to a physical location. And now they can sign up, they can participate, they can do it multiple times a day, you get much better data. And so what ended up happening when this app was released is within 24 hours, it became the largest Parkinson's study
amazing.
In the history
of
the
great?
Disease.
Just amazing.
And what's even more interesting is, as you pointed out, we're already seeing insights. Usually it takes a long time in these studies to see insights.
Right.
And within the first few months, we're already seeing cases where it's clear that the medication that people are taking is not helping their symptoms. We also believe that this app or some modification of it could ultimately diagnose Parkinson's, which is just powerful when you think of the democratization of medicine.
Right.
So we think the potential is huge. Another example is asthma. Mount Sinai wanted to study what are the exacerbators of asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And Mount Sinai is based in New York. If they were doing this study in the traditional process, they would have had people around New York City. So with Research Kit, they launch an app, and people all over the United States now are sending information into the Research Kit study. The GPS on the phone tracks where the person is going. The Bluetooth inhalers that they use for asthma record how often they're using their inhaler. And what's fascinating is now they're studying that different things can cause asthma in different locations. It's not a one-size-fits-all.
Exactly.
So people in Texas, the number one cause of asthma is extreme heat, and in the New Jersey area, it seems to be anger as the number one precipitator of asthma. And so it's this fascinating way that you can study in a broad population and gain these powerful insights.
We're speaking today with Jeff Williams, Chief Operating Officer of Apple, overseeing the development of Apple Watch and driving the company's health initiatives, including Research Kit, which is aimed at simplifying medical and health research. Jeff, there are approximately 50 million Americans now utilizing some health tracking wearable device, but statistics show that some of these devices tend to sort of fall off. Tell our listeners how you envision the growth of the health sector within Apple, which is still a very small portion of your overall business, as American healthcare becomes better equipped with health data interoperability. What do you envision the future will look like from Apple's perspective?
Look, we're well aware of the sort of the drop-off of fitness tracking devices, but the Apple Watch is different. It's something you interact with, and it does more than that. We think Apple Watch marks the end of single-function wrist devices.
Hmm.
In the same way, the iPhone marked the end of single-function cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you interact throughout the day with your Apple Watch for communications and payment and scheduling. So we're just at the beginning of this. We don't, as I mentioned, really think in terms of segments and markets. We think in terms of what do people want. And I'm a strong believer that people want to be more active participants in their health.
Mm-hmm.
Physicians will tell you that having the consumer engaged in their own health will have more impact than any medicine they can give them, and we think we have a huge opportunity to help do that.
Well, Jeff, I noticed certainly some of the areas you've touched on are very near and dear to our work and our hearts, certainly focus on underserved populations, on the democratization of health. And when you think about global health and the world's underserved population, give us a little bit of an insight or understanding, if you will, of how scalable is this technology in advancing global health research and improving global health? And how are you going to bring this to bear maybe in some of the third world markets?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that interests us most in Apple. If you think about where medicine is today, and we're big believers in the democratization potential of this, the injustice of fantastic health care available in some parts of the world and others suffering needlessly. And so this is really exciting. I'll give you an example. One of my favorite Research Kit study apps is on autism and the early detection of autism. This was done by Duke, and Duke approached us and wanted to do a research kit study. The goal of the study is to determine whether you can use a cell phone to detect autism at an early age. And when they first approached me, I thought, does it really make a difference mm-hmm. just labeling a child early? And it turns out it mm-hmm. really does.
It does.
Because there are interventions, but mm-hmm. you need to do these interventions while the brain's developing. And if you wait till a child is 5 or 6 or 7 years old, it's too late. The average age of diagnosis in the U.S. is about 6 years. And so in other countries, it's even later than that. And if you, in the U.S., you want to, for example, at Duke, get an appointment with somebody to see a physician for that diagnosis, it takes a year. And so the concept here is put the child in your lap, you play a little video on the phone, and the front-facing camera actually watches the child's face, does facial recognition, and looks for how the child responds to the video. And they believe with a high degree of certainty that they can detect autism, and this study goes to prove that. And so not only could you do the diagnosis and screening, the interventions are largely activities that you would do to help develop the brain, and you could actually deliver the therapy and treatment over the phone. When we met with psychiatrists who are specialists in this area, they said in Africa, what they told us is there are 55 people in all of Africa that are trained specialists in autism to do this
exactly.
for a population of over a billion. And so the power of taking smartphones into that region and having an impact on people's lives in terms of their IQ and their social skills by intervening early on autism, that's the kind of thing that makes us get up in the morning.
Yep.
Yeah, well, that's an exciting morning. You have a pretty big portfolio at Apple, and I'd like you to just share a little of the work that you've been doing on the company's social responsibilities initiatives, the work that Apple's doing not only here in the United States but around the globe.
Yeah, we're big believers that anybody involved in the process of working on an Apple product, they deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. And we've really decided that workers' rights are human rights. And we do a lot of work to make sure that workers are protected. And we still have a long ways to go, but we are training workers on their rights. We've trained millions of workers on their fundamental rights. We are bringing new levels of health and safety into regions, and it extends well beyond Apple. We set up universities to help develop skills that train people on how to run safer factories. And let me tell you, no company wants to talk about child labor. They don't want to be associated with that. Apple takes a completely different approach. We shine a light on it. Mm-hmm. We go out and search for cases where an underage worker is found in a factory somewhere, and then we take drastic actions with the supplier, the upstream labor groups, to try to make change, and then we report it publicly every year. And we take a lot of heat for that. It's easier to, but we think the only way we're going to make change is to go hit it head on and talk about it. So we're doing a lot of work in this space. We post that on our web. I don't know that a lot of people read it, but if you go there, you'll see a lot of information about what we're doing, and I couldn't be happier.
Great. Well, we've been speaking today with Jeff Williams, Chief Operating Officer of Apple. You can learn more about their work by going to apple.com or follow them on Twitter @Apple. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to be with you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Barack Obama said there have been huge drops in the murder rates in cities like New York, Los Angeles, and Dallas. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump said, quote, violent crime has increased in cities across America. Which is it? We'll score this one for Obama. The long-term trend is a decline, not only in the murder rates per population, but the total number of murders in the cities Obama mentioned and nationwide. The same goes for violent crime. Trump was referring to a recent year-over-year increase in murders in some cities. Let's take Dallas as an example. Murders there peaked in 1991 at 500 for the year, but they totaled nearly half that, 231, in 2000. That's according to data from the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Statistics, which are based on reports from local police departments. In 2012, murders in Dallas were lower yet, 154. The murder rate, offenses per 100,000 in population, dropped significantly too. But Trump pointed to a New York Times article on an uptick in 2015 in the number of murders in several cities, including Dallas, as compared with 2014. All told for 2015, Dallas saw a 17% increase in the number of murders from the year before. But as criminology and statistics experts told us, we can't discern a trend from a few years of data. The violent crime rate, which includes murders, aggravated assaults, rape, and robbery, for the nation also hit a peak in the early 1990s and has been declining since. Obama said that violent crime has declined over the last 5, 10, 20, 30 years. That's true, but he went too far in claiming that it's, quote, the lowest it's been since probably the 1960s. The rate is lower than it has been since 1970, but violent crime was lower in the 1960s than it has been in recent years. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Cancer research can be long, laborious, frustrating, isolating. And often when research breakthroughs in treatment or pathology occur, they remain entrenched within their respective institutions for far too long before being shared with the broader clinical populations. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine have launched a program to address that research fragmentation. They've created a new system that facilitates data and biospecimen sharing among cancer centers that may significantly speed cancer research findings from the laboratory to patient care.
You know, one of the major problems is that the data is very siloed in information systems, often produced by vendors. And the other problem is that the data that is probably the most relevant, especially when you're interested in sharing and using biomaterials, the data that's most relevant is often in text. So not only is it locked away sort of within a vendor clinical system, but it's also, in a lot of ways, locked away in the text because it can't be processed by machines.
Dr. Rebecca Jacobson, professor of biomedical informatics at Pitt School of Medicine and chief information officer at the Institute for Personalized Medicine, says the system they've created, the TIES Cancer Research Network, or TCRN, was built upon their development of an advanced data texting system that can easily share complex research data across a broad spectrum of users. With the TCRN, they can study rare diseases and rare behaviors of common diseases much more effectively because they can now aggregate and access data and biomaterials across multiple institutions that hasn't been logistically possible until now.
Our software is combined with the legal agreements, the policies that enable individual researchers at different institutions to be able to access data across the network. And once they know that they have a sufficient number of cases, a collaborator at another institution, then they can use the policies and processes that we've set up to be able to get a set of biomaterials from those institutions.
They already have a number of partners connected through their TCRN Federation of Cancer Hospitals and are hoping to significantly expand their research scope to many more partners. The TIES Cancer Research Network, linking cancer researchers from around the country on a new sort of data and biomaterial sharing superhighway, aimed at getting researchers the breakthrough information they need to accelerate the path to cures. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.